Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Glad you could join us. My name is Scott Linden. I'm the host. Also hosting Wing Shooting USA, the TV show on the Pursuit Channel right now, and YouTube all the time. And any day now, I'm told, Amazon Prime. So check it out. Great show in store for you. You know the adage, you put two dog owners in a room and you'll get three opinions about dog food. Well, I've got the guy who created the website, dogfoodadvisor.com. Yeah, Dr. Mike Sagman will be joining us talking about all things dog food, performance, byproducts, this whole grain-free kerfuffle, you name it, we'll be talking dog food. We'll also have a great public access tip for you to one of my favorite places, some hunting strategy and dog handling advice. Once again, real-world advice from somebody who actually goes out and does it. Some adventures and strategies, tips and techniques. It's all coming up on the Upland Nation podcast. In the meanwhile, though, well, for all of us, I think, unless you're, you know, hunting preserves, your season, your wild bird season, your bird dog season, however you describe it, it's pretty much wrapped up. So the question on my Facebook page was, now what? What are you going to do now to get ready or just to kind of keep yourself from going stir crazy? Lots of interesting answers. Yes, and here are some of the things I promise to do. Thank you for your suggestions, by the way. I'm going to take another shooting lesson or two. It's time to get back and dialed in on that. See how many bad habits I've picked up over the season. I'm also going to fish more, leave the fly rods in the truck so that every time I drive past a trout stream, I can at least play with the idea of going fishing. From the Facebook page, Lance Larson, one of my top fans. Hello, Lance. He says, get shopping for that new shotgun. Hey, great idea. Sponsor Cabela's has a $300 off sale on many of their guns. Go to Cabela's.com and check it out, by the way. Tell them I sent you. Sure appreciate that. Fan Jack Gable says, keep running and training the dogs. If you love your dog, train steady to wing and shot. Good idea. I'm going a step further. That's my number one goal with Flick is wing, shot, and fall. Wish me luck. Rich Klein says, clean and wipe down everything. And then a couple days later, do it again because I'm sure you'll forget something. And you are so right. I just pulled a couple shotguns out of the truck. After being at the beach for a couple days in the salt air, I'm glad I got it in time. Anthony Besnar, by the way, good luck on the new puppies. They look great. He says, closed season? I ignore it. Okay, whatever that means. Just don't be breaking any laws, Anthony. And Peter Wettergreen says, take out the batteries in all your electronic devices. Great idea. Thank you for that. And Palmer Grigsby, just about the same, only with your gun. Always check the choke tubes. Keep them lubed up so they don't seize. And Palmer, Anthony, Peter, Rich, Lance, Jack, good job on all of that. Hey, and there is the call that I've been waiting for. So let's get right to the phones. Of course, that's when my producer reminds me that I can't get to the phones until I sage and breaker you. Gun care and cleaning products crafted at the highest caliber, sageandbreaker.com. I was at Pheasant Fest a few weeks back, got a hands-on look at both their new cleaning chamois and their firearms grease. And if you are signed up for their mailing list, you would have found out about that stuff before everybody else. We're also brought to you by Dogtra and their new T&B Dual Collar. It's my training collar of choice. Find out more about it and how to save a whole bunch of money at Dogtra.com. All right, now I am ready to get on the phone with Dr. Mike Sagman. Mike is the founder and administrator, guru, and creator of dogfoodadvisor.com. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
Tell me, why would you start something with a, I mean, that is, I'm sorry for the pun, but that's a big bite to bite off and start chewing. What was your inspiration for dogfoodadvisor.com?
Scott, I've loved dogs all my life. And my family and I, back in the mid to late 90s, we rescued a little dog that had been abused. And her name was Penny. And we spent many years working through all her problems from those abusive relationships that she had. And in 2007, she became a victim of the largest recall, pet food recall in U.S. history. This was the recall that involved the importation of a contaminated batch of weak gluten from Chinese sources. And it had been that the wheat gluten had been intentionally bastardized by adding melamine, which is a plastic, to trick the manufacturers, believing there was more protein in it than there was. And this was one of those things that it was an ingredient that had been purchased by over 100 different brand names, including some of the most famous ones in the country. So it was not a manufacturer, but it was a supplier, and it killed thousands of dogs. It had made national news, and Penny, we believe, was one of the victims of that recall. We were never sure. So I just made it a point to I wanted to do something about it. I was very frustrated with how I was treated on the phone when I contacted one of those manufacturers. The person that I spoke with just seemed to be as cold as possible about it. Seemed to be could have cared less. And a friend of mine suggested I started a blog. And I remember asking him back. Remember, this is back in 2008 when I finally got it started. I said, "What's a blog?" And that blog is now a fairly busy website.
Yeah, I'll say that's the understatement of the day. Well, I'm sorry for your tragedy. A lot of our listeners have probably feared that, if not gone through it themselves. And it's nice to know that there is a somewhat happy ending out of it. You've been helping thousands and thousands of other people since then. What do you offer on the dogfoodadvisor.com site? Tell us in a nutshell how it will help us.
Well, our goal has always been, you know, when I first started the website, we had no reviews. I just spent time writing, looking into the pet food industry, and I was kind of shocked by what can go into dog food, all the different ingredients, and some of them they surprised me. There was out of date grocery store meats, roadkill, literally. There are rendering facilities throughout the country, little small places that pick up or purchase the roadkill. At one time, even euthanized cats and dogs could be recycled and used to create various meat proteins, meat ingredients, meat meals. And the more I looked into it, it really kind of bothered me. So I started by writing these articles, and when I started seeing all the things that were happening, I decided I didn't want anyone else to go through what we went through. And we started probably about second or third year into the process, and we started reviewing dog foods and looking at the labels and whatever things we could get from it. And I also started a mailing list, which has become one of the most popular features on our website. It was a free mailing list, and we still do, and we notify. We'll write an article about each recall when it happens. As soon as the article is written, within a few hours, we broadcast it to hundreds of thousands of subscribers. And in my opinion, it's the first line of defense to keep you from becoming, or your pet from becoming, a victim of the next recall.
I love it. It has been of great use to me personally. I'll be talking about my dog food sponsor later on in the program, which gets a very high rating from you, and I'm grateful for that as well. You know, you've got to, I mean, you must have to go out and buy these dog foods and then do something with them so that you can tell us why they're good or why they're bad. What's that process entail?
That's a great question. And people, I think they pictured that I've got a warehouse just full of every dog food. The truth is that many of the dog foods that we review on our website, we have no access to. There are many dog foods in the United States are regional. Sold by various feed manufacturers, regional in certain states. So it's impossible for us to have access, or for any of us to have access to all of them. So we use the closest thing we can get is which is the actual pet food companies they place on their websites, and we get the material from there, and then we base our reviews on those ingredients. The reason we chose ingredients as one of the criteria is because they are regulated. It doesn't mean that that the companies are always honest, but the FDA requires companies to be honest and accurate in what they place on there, and they're subject to federal laws and regulation if they're dishonest. So that keeps things pretty much standardized and helped us a lot to develop the standards we use to rate the foods.
So you're auditing pretty good data in there. There's also another organization that I think is involved in the dog food world, maybe all sorts of other animal feeds as well, and I've forgotten what their acronym is, but it's something like AFTA or something. Do they have a role in the quality control side of things as well?
The quality control itself is it's one of those things that it's left mainly to each individual manufacturer. You're not allowed to commit fraud, and the government doesn't like that. But when you place something on a food label here in this country, it's regulated by the FDA. The organization I believe that you're referring to is AFCO, which is spelled AAFCO. It stands for the Association of American Feed Control Officials. And they set the definition. So, you can't just make up things. Some pet food companies we find do use, like, they'll put on the ingredient a label, they'll say like human grade meat. That's not an authorized word or a phrase that's allowed to be used. That can be used on the packaging, but on the actual ingredient label itself, whether it's chewing gum or food or pet food or human food, it makes no difference. That's regulated. AFCO sets those definitions for those various words and creates standards for them. Here's one of the things that I think most people do not understand, and I think your readers should be aware of this. AFCO does not test or authorize any dog food, and I see people online constantly saying it's AFCO approved, and these aren't manufacturers. These are usually various pet food forums around the country. I see people constantly saying, hey, it's an AFCO-approved product. AFCO doesn't approve any dog foods at all. The FDA bases its standard on those standards that are established by AFCO. So I don't know if that helps any, but again, I would urge people not to put... I really am thankful that we have AFCO. Up until the mid-90s, we had no standards in the industry at all of whatever you wanted to put on there.
Wow.
But AFCO is very important. The most important thing that AFCO does is AFCO sets what are called nutrient profiles. This is really, I think, an important concept. And one of the reasons that pet owners do not need to be nutritionists. You'll see things constantly that, implying that you need to go to a veterinarian in order to find out what foods are approved or appropriate. And a veterinarian can be an excellent source. But the most important thing is that you want to make sure that we can talk about this later, that one of the most important mistakes that I think people make is that one of the most important things to start with is you want to start by matching your dog's, I call it a feeding type, which is a combination of their breed or breed type and their stage of life. So meaning there's a difference between what you feed a puppy versus an adult. And although there's not an official level for seniors, that's another level. That's a stage of life.
Sure,
a breed. The breed is important, too, because, larger breeds are more prone to certain conditions. And smaller breeds actually have a much greater latitude for what you can feed them. But large breed puppies can be prone to various orthopedic problems, the most common being canine hip dysplasia, CHD. And so they need a special, you know, special diet.
Yeah, and you know, I learned that, you know, five wire hair puppies ago, that the point of that large breed puppy food is not what you might think it is. It's actually to moderate the speed at which the animal grows, isn't it?
It is, and it's the, what's really unique about foods that are appropriate for large breed puppies is the amount of calcium in the food.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to have too much calcium or too little calcium. Both of those things are important, but too much calcium is the dangerous component of feeding a regular standard puppy food. People don't realize they see puppy food, and they think, well, I've got a puppy, so I'm going to feed my puppy that. And that's why I mentioned to you the first thing. I see people becoming obsessed about whether a food has been recalled or not, or whether chicken is the first ingredient. These are incredibly misleading and unimportant parameters for buying food. What's far more important, step number one, is the determining what your dog's feeding type is.
Yeah.
And that's determined by their breed. Because let's be honest about it. When is a dog become an adult depends on the breed. So if you have a small breed puppy, they're adults become adults at depending on which one, 6, 7, 8, 9 months. Whereas a giant breed like a Great Dane can be still eating puppy food until they're 24 months, 2 years. It's far safer to feed a puppy food to an adult than it is ever to feed an adult food to a puppy.
I remember when
I first started in this business, I saw many websites that would recommend you switch to an adult food as soon as possible if you're feeding a large breed puppy, because they used to believe it had something to do with protein content, but that's just simply not true. It has to do with the calcium content of the food.
Very useful. And by the way, let me just remind everybody, that's Dr. Mike Sagman. He's the founder of dogfoodadvisor.com. I'm Scott Linden, your host at the Upland Nation podcast. Mike, can you define a few of these terms that we do see on the label in the, not the guaranteed analysis, but on the ingredient side? And we'll get to the guaranteed analysis next, because that is something I'm obsessive about, and I think a lot of other guys in the bird hunting and bird dog world are as well. But for example, meat versus meat meal. Can you give us a distinction there?
Yes. Meat is exactly like it sounds. It's like what you find in the grocery store. It doesn't mean that it's the same quality, but just the point is you can picture that in your mind. That's when you see it on the label. If it says chicken, like poultry, fish, beef, that's meat. Meat meal is meat that's been cooked to a very high temperature and rendered, and so that the moisture is cooked off of it and the oils and fats go to the top. And then the meat is left as a powder that's eventually dried and put in the food. There is no such thing as human grade meat meal. You can't go in the grocery store and buy chicken meal. So when you see chicken meal, that's a pet food product or pet food ingredient. Now, in the defense of that, it's very, very difficult. Most of us feed kibbles, and one of the main reasons that's what we feed is because it's affordable. I'm not saying that's the main reason that you should buy it, but I'm just saying that's why it's so popular. It doesn't require any refrigeration. There's a whole list of positives, but meat meal makes it possible to have kibble. There are very few kibbles that have high protein that are made with all fresh ingredients. They do exist, but it's an incredibly difficult process because the process of making kibble is a bakery product. And if you put, you know, too much meat in to get the protein level up, it doesn't actually form this gelatin that's eventually baked and turned into kibble.
Yeah.
The process of making kibble is by extruding it from little squirt tubes and then slicing it into little tiny biscuits that you see when you open the bag. So that's the difference is meat and meat meal. So meat meal you need to think of as a meat concentrate. It's concentrated meat. There's a lot more protein. And so this has nothing, you know, if you're trying to feed a you know, your dog fresh meat, that's just kibble. There's nothing fresh about kibble. It's a processed food.
Well, good to know. How about some of those other things that may or may not be so good for us? What if you had to start a top 10 list? We don't need to go through all 10, but the top 10 list of the byproducts that we probably want to avoid. What are on that list?
Well, that's a good thing that you brought up. Let's backtrack just a little bit. There's a big difference between when you see something on a label that says turkey meal is different than meat meal, or because when you see the word, a generic word like meat meal, what is that? Is that beef? Is it chicken? If you have an animal that's allergic, they're most likely allergic to the protein. So where does that protein come from? How would you know if you saw meat meal on a label? So we consider that a very low-grade version of meat meal, and we consider that we will downgrade a food when we see the words meat meal. That's kind of a cop-out. What we want to see is buffalo meal, beef meal, you know, name the species, and then the word meal. Sometimes you'll see poultry meal, which doesn't tell you whether it's a chicken, turkey, or duck, but still, that's much better than the word meat meal. And you mentioned that, what about byproducts? Byproducts is another thing we all make a mistake. We assume the word byproduct is a very bad thing. But the byproducts of animal processing and slaughter are organ meats, like liver. That's loaded with nutrients. Kidney. And, you know, in the wild, a dog would eat the entire animal. So those byproducts, we don't have a problem with that. We have a problem with unidentified byproducts, where it says something like meat byproducts. That's like meat meal. We don't like that word. And so we go out of our way to downgrade any product that won't tell the consumer what that meat comes from. I hope that makes sense to you.
Oh, it's enlightening. You know, I'm like many. Well, a byproduct is a byproduct, but we forget that you're absolutely right. Organ meat, for example, as you mentioned, is pretty darn good for most animals most of the time. Now, I'm not going to be eating any sweetbreads in the near future, but... My dog would gobble them up. But there are some bad ones out there. In the old days, I remember, hearing and learning about feathers and beaks and claws and things like. Is anybody still trying to get away with that?
Well, it is true that there are AFCO permits the definition of certain types of byproducts to allow those things to be in there. But some of the definitions do specifically, you know, say that you can't have hair or feathers and things like it. By the way, those things can be high in protein, but they're not really digestible protein. So, that's not something that you would want. But again, when you see, a chicken or poultry byproduct meal, it does sound awful, I have to admit, but, you know, because poultry, what is it? Is it a duck, a chicken, and it's a byproduct? But again, you know that it's a bird, and, you know, I would feel better if I saw a chicken byproduct meal or turkey byproduct meal, but poultry byproduct meal is not too bad. But when you see that word meat, another one I don't like is animal fat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you noticed one of the emails that we sent out a few months ago was about a warning letter that the FDA had issued to a company in Winchester, Virginia, that had discovered euthanasia drugs in the animal fat, and that's you know fairly. I don't want to mean like it's common, like happens every day, but it's not unusual to find euthanasia drugs in you know if an animal is downed in the slaughterhouse, they may have to euthanize the animal. The law does not allow that, but it does get by sometimes. So I don't like animal fat. We do like chicken fat, beef tallow, because we're naming the species. But when you see animal fat, and by the way, I don't want to name a manufacturer, but one of the largest manufacturers in this country uses animal fat routinely. And I happen to love their products, but we downgrade their. We've explained this to the manufacturer repeatedly that we give them a lower rating. And I'm going to tell you why they do this. They do it because, you know, they print bags they don't print like four bags. They print tens of thousands, maybe a million bags with their printing companies that manufacture the packaging. And this gives them the leeway, like if this week they have a tanker full of chicken fat and next week they can get, you know, fat from beef or something else at a lower price, by just having the word animal fat on there, they can get away with that. So we don't like that. We feel like that as consumers, whether it's our pets or our babies or grandchildren, I think we have the right to know what's in the food that we consume and the food of our pets.
Amen to that. That's Dr. Mike Sagman, dogfoodadvisor.com. We're getting up on a break, but before we do, let's get warmed up for the next and the hottest topic right now, and that is grain versus grain-free. Can you kind of get the discussion going? I think there's some distinctions about the types of other products substituting for grain as being an issue there. Can you get us started on that, Mike?
Well, what you're hearing about is what's called dilated cardiomyopathy, DCM. And, we've discovered in the last couple of years that there's a higher incidence of that. And a veterinarian, I'm almost certain he's on the West Coast, and I'm sorry I'm not bringing his name up right now, and a few others around the country have tried to make a connection. And the FDA sent out an alert about that in 2018. I believe it was July or June of 2018, saying that there's some kind of a connection between, possible connection between grain-free food and the incidence of dilated cardiomyopathy, which we'll refer to as DCM. But the most recent information, I believe a lot of this information has been put out prematurely, and it's really creating a tremendous scare and misunderstanding in people. I see people talking about pea protein is what's causing it. Everybody's trying to put their finger on something. I have seen lots of explanations, and I'm not, you know, certain. And the FDA has intentionally gone out of their way to let people know we're not really sure what the relationship is. But it's now starting to look more and more, the more we read, that it is definitely related specifically to genetics, and meaning specific breeds show the condition more frequently than others. You'll hear the word taurine. Taurine is an amino acid that makes up protein. Taurine is not considered an essential amino acid. But what if you're a particular breed, or your particular breed of your dog does not manufacture its own taurine, and requires it as an additive? So right now, where you're going to see lots of dog food companies appear to be adding it, when we go over their ingredients and update their foods, we're seeing more and more taurine being added. But again, that is not the smoking gun. I'm not going to be able to help you much, because right now we're waiting for the FDA and the industry to come to some final conclusions on what the exact cause is. Well, the main thing right now is that scientists believe that it's multifactorial, meaning that there are many factors that contribute to whether or not you see the condition of DCM.
Good to hear. Very good to hear. And because I feed a grain-free, and I bet a lot of other people out there do. In the background, Dr. Mike and everybody else is hearing my cue to take a quick commercial break. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. Dr. Mike Sagman, dogfoodadvisor.com, is our guest, trying to cover just about the entire waterfront, if you will, on performance dogs and dog food. Mike, you can take a little break, put your feet up for a moment while I yak on here about a couple things, and then I'll bring you right back. Thanks so much for being on the program. The rest of you, hang on, because right after the break, our Handle It segment and a dog handling question that I, once again, learned the hard way. And appropriate for this break, Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food, our newest sponsor here at the Upland Nation podcast. I've been feeding it for years and years, and one of the reasons is it does get a great rating at dogfoodadvisor.com. One of the reasons for that is the protein levels. Almost all the proteins in almost all the varieties of Dr. Tim's food are animal sources with an overall average of 87% of the protein in the foods. In other words, the corn or corn gluten or any other sources of protein are not very prevalent or very common in Dr. Tim's foods. Now, I haven't explained that as well as you will be explained to if you go to drtims.com, drtims.com, where if you do make an order and you use the code that I will give you in just a moment, then you will get a massive discount, 30% off on your first order. Upland Nation is all you need to know. All caps, Upland Nation will get you 30% off your first order at DRTIMS, drtims.com. And if you're not hearing me as well as you used to, it might be because you're shooting without hearing protection. ESPAmerica.com is where you can learn every aspect of why it's important to use hearing protection in the field as well as on the range. My friend Jack Homa will help you with all of that at ESPAmerica.com. You know, every time you shoot a gun without proper hearing protection, you're assaulting your ears with up to 150 decibels of deafening sound. Repeat that over the course of a day in the field, especially if you're chasing doves or something like that. Oh boy, you are in big trouble. ESPAmerica.com is where you learn more all about all the things that Jack can offer you in the way of pricing, options, colors, and everything else. It's all personalized just for you with custom fitting at ESPAmerica.com. This was a year for all sorts of wonderful things in the field, my friends, including some eye-opening observations that Flick, my young wire hair, helped facilitate. As you well know, if you watch my TV show, I'm not a very good shot. I wing-clipped a lot of birds, and I seem to have been hunting with a lot of guys who wing-clipped their birds, too. So in this Handle It segment, I'm going to tell you something that worked over and over again in South Dakota, Oregon, Nevada, and Kansas this year. In fact, you can probably watch it on the show next week from Kansas and some walk-in properties we hunted there. When you do finally give up, and I hope you give it the old college try on a wing-clipped bird, make a note of where it is. Mark it on your GPS if you have to, but somehow make a note of it. The first chucker I shot on a recent trip swung around, went down the hill, all the way down the hill, and around the corner of a big rocky outcropping. We looked and looked and looked. When I finally did give up, I marked it on the GPS. We hunted the rest of that chucker hunt, another 2 hours, all the way up again and all the way around. On the way back down, we hunted into the wind at about the spot where I thought I marked that downed bird. Beep, beep. There goes the GPS transmitter. It tells me that Flick is on point. By the time I find him, he's ankle deep in a little creek. And what is nestled under the sagebrush? That wing-clipped chucker. That happened 3 more times this season. So when you have the chance, think about handling your dog back into the wind on the way back to the truck or on the way back down to camp. There's a good chance that bird has emitted enough scent to actually be noticeable by your dog, and hopefully by you too. Good luck out there. And let's get back to the program. All right, joining me in the Cabela's podcast studio, Dr. Mike Sagman, the creator of dogfoodadvisor.com. And welcome also to our new listeners. We've got listeners from Canada to the Netherlands to Chile to the United Kingdom. And then one guy, Heyman, in Jamaica too. Mike, are you there?
I am.
Oh, good. I'm glad you didn't give up on me. Thank you. I'm flattered. We were talking about grain versus grain free, and I'm glad we're at some point we'll get an answer on that. But at this point, we don't need to panic like our hair's on fire. But there've got to be some other ingredients out there, and we talked about a few that are of questionable value. And I got to tell you, Over the years, I've used a lot of dog foods, some with quail eggs, some with blueberries, some with beet pomace, I think it's called. Do those all have value? Why do manufacturers put 45 things in a bag of dog food?
A lot of the things are, the one way to think of it, Scott, is that there are what are called macronutrients and micronutrients. And micronutrients are, just like the name sounds, they're the minerals and the vitamins that are in the food. And a lot of the things, they're always listed at the end of the ingredients list because they're in the smallest quantities. The law requires all the ingredients to be listed according to the amount of their pre-cooking weight, in other words, before they're cooked, from the highest to the lowest. And by the way, I hope you'll remind me to bring up something called ingredient splitting to show you how companies, pet food companies, can really manipulate what you see on that label, and they do it legally. The reason you see so many and why they look like chemical names is because they frequently will show the name of the vitamin instead of saying vitamin E. They'll name the tocopherol or tocopherol version of the vitamin. So don't be discouraged by seeing all those things on there. The place to really focus is in the top of the ingredient list. And a lot of them, unless it's a limited ingredient diet, will put, more than one protein in the food. That's very
sure.
common.
Yeah.
So they'll put different meats and that type of thing. One of the things, if you'll allow me to just go back to something we're talking about, is that how do we rate foods? Well, what I tell people is that the ratings you see on our website are based on the label mostly, almost exclusively. That the 5-star, 4-star, 3 stars are based on whether or not we're finding those really bad ingredients in there. If they are, they're going to be rated 1 or 2 stars. The better, the ones that don't have really serious red flag ingredients are going to be rated higher. Also, I heard you mention guaranteed analysis. We do rate foods higher if they are have more protein and better quality fats in them, and we'll rate them higher. But the mistake I see people making, and when they talk to each other in forums, they'll say this dog food is rated 4-star on the Dog Food Advisor. That means that it's got a 4-star label. But some dog foods are made by companies that never test their finished products. And some are designed by amateurs. They may have a good ingredient panel and a good guaranteed analysis, but question these companies, they're not put together by professionals. Sometimes those professionals are veterinarians. Some of them are nutritionists. So we created a list. On our website, we have about, at this time, 24 or 25 lists that start with the word best. So it might say best dry dog foods, best wet dog foods, best grain-free dog foods, best dog foods with grain. Those take into consideration the label rating, which, they're usually 4- and 5-star foods that are on that list. Occasionally 3.5 stars if there's a really good reason to put one of those on there. But these are foods that we have vetted. And this information isn't available on the label. These are manufacturers that we trust. And then the newest thing we've added in the last few years, which we could not do earlier, is that, the one individual that we're not able to talk to are the dogs themselves. So thanks to the internet, and websites like Chewy and like Amazon, we get the next best thing. We get an opportunity to read, and we suggest everyone do that. It's okay to read label ratings. Ours are editorial ratings, where we look at the label and we give our editorial opinion, just like reading a good book. But one of the consultants we should all consider are our dogs and the consumers that feed the dogs, because they can see the dog's stools. They can see the dog's response. The labels don't tell you whether the food is palatable or not, but your dog, you're looking at his or her tail and her response to the food. So those three things, we call that the holy grail of deciding whether a food is good. We look at the label rating. So does it have a good ingredient panel, a good guaranteed analysis? Secondarily, is it made by a company that we can trust? And thirdly, what do actual users and buyers and dogs have to say if you could poll them? And again, that's probably the least scientific, but if you get enough reviews together, you can begin to see a pattern. We've seen one particular food that says, this food smells terrible, but my dog loves it. And you see that comment four or five times, you can pretty much say, you know what? That food smells bad, but the dogs like it.
So it smells bad to the humans, but not to the dogs.
Exactly. I mean, I always tell people that dog food may be 5 stars on my website, but it's 2 stars in your dog's mind. So we want to get their rating too. And we've learned lately, we rely heavily on the foods we put on those best dog food lists. We're doing our best. That's one of the most challenging parts of our job, because we read lots of these reviews. And again, we don't try to look at one review, but as large a section as we can.
I'm reminded of a question I asked of a major dog food manufacturer who will remain unnamed here, but most of us know who I'm talking about, who I put my hand up in a big crowd one day and asked, well, you know, that's all well and good, but have you tasted it yet? And they have yet to return a phone call.
But, I'm asked that all the time. I always feel like saying to people, we haven't tasted it. We don't know.
Yeah, and I guess back in the day, in another career, I was going to be doing some consulting with a regional dog food manufacturer, and I had heard on the grapevine that those guys every day did their own quality control, and I thought, what a brilliant idea!
Yeah. Brilliant.
But nobody's really doing that. I mean, it's some of that stuff is bad enough if you just hold your head over the bowl when you're serving it to your dog.
No, that's really not true. There's a whole new segment of dog foods that you'll be hearing a lot more about, like a farmer's dog, that you'll see quite a few of them that are actually fresh-made dog food.
Yeah.
They're very expensive, and it's not for everybody. It's certainly not for the faint of heart or those, you know, on a tight budget. But those foods are truly human grade, and you'll see them say this is the same food, you know, that we eat.
Sure.
We eat it ourselves because it's fresh ingredients that are cooked and then frozen. So can't really say that. I do want to, if it's okay for me to introduce one more thing that would help you with the grain-free scare, which is overblown. I think that the FDA did a terrible disservice to the industry by naming 14 specific manufacturers that had more cases of DCM. They also happen to be the 14 most popular dog foods. So the science, by choosing those foods, obviously, if more dogs are eating them, then they would have a higher percentage, and it would look like these brands are tainted. But one of the things that we truly believe in, and I believe this greatly, you know, when we feed our dogs, we want to lower the risk. The risk of feeding them a food that is not exactly right. I always tell everybody that I meet, there is no such thing as a perfect dog food. Even a 5-star food has probably got plenty of flaws. The problem is we don't know what they are. We don't know if there are contaminants in the food. We don't know if the nutrients are really that perfectly balanced. I mean, do they test every batch? And even if they did get it exactly like recommended, is that the best balance for your dog? And so we recommend something known as diet rotation or menu rotation, which greatly decreases your dog's risk of eating a dog food that is tainted. In 2019, just last year, I'm sure that many of your readers are aware of this, but one of the most trusted manufacturers in the country, Hill's Science Diet, fell victim to a very similar problem that many smaller manufacturers, particularly in the southeastern part of the United States, fell to, which is a defective batch of supplements that are added to the food. Almost all manufactured foods have vitamin supplements, vitamin mineral supplements, and they had purchased a pack that had too much vitamin D in it. And this caused renal failure and killed a number of dogs. The problem is that when Hill's had this problem, I'm going to give you a slightly inaccurate number. I believe it was around 40 different SKUs. And this recall, before they actually recalled the product, before they knew that it was defective, the defective product had been out for quite a while. So the problem comes from if you have too much vitamin D or too much of a particular mineral or anything else, even a contaminant. It becomes magnified if you feed it every single day, every single meal. One of the things that I believe helps all of us, humans and pets, is by eating a diversified diet. Now, Scott, that doesn't mean every dog's digestive system can tolerate a lot of rotation, and by rotation I'm referring to changing the food periodically. And there are various versions of diet rotation, which are some are very dramatic and some are just very modest, and I can share those with you in a minute. But when you rotate the diet and you switch, you are decreasing the risk of feeding if there's a batch of defective dog food that you're giving your pet. If you just keep buying the same brand, the same package over and over again, your risk of feeding a defective diet rises. So I like to assume from the very beginning that there is no such thing as a perfect dog food. And rather than, you know, forcing this on your pet every single day, every single meal, so when you run out of a package, rotate the diet. And if your dog can tolerate that, my dog has always, every dog I've had has been able to tolerate it. But it's almost like stocks in the stock market. If you buy one particular stock, you can get very rich, but you can also get very poor very quickly. And diversification in diet makes just as much sense as it makes in buying stocks. It lowers your risk. Now, one last thing is that there's levels of diet rotation. If I was going to switch, if you're using a particular brand of dog food, just switching from the same sub brand, such as Purina Pro Plan, from the chicken to the turkey to the beef flavor, that's a very mild rotation. A stronger type of rotation would be literally switching from, say, Purina Pro Plan to Purina Dog Chow. Although they're both made by Purina, those are getting more dramatically different. And then switching completely brands altogether from Purina to Royal Canin or to Origin, then you have a little bit more chance of having a stomach upset. So, but, you know, I can't stress enough, if you're worried about grain-free, why not feed one batch of grain-free and the next batch you go, and I believe many of these companies sell both grain-free and grain-inclusive. So you can switch from grain-free to grain-inclusive. Then that way, if there is a problem with grain-free, your dog is far less likely to have a problem than one who is just fed the same dog food, the same brand, the same flavor, day in and day out. Then batches, which batch you're feeding your dog could be the results of having a defective batch magnified.
Oh, absolutely, and I'm a believer in that as well. And protein sources are the easiest thing to switch, like you said. Sometimes that's where the allergies lie, as you mentioned earlier, and that's one of the first things I jump to when somebody asks me why their dog is scratching all the time or they got ear infections. I'm no veterinarian, but it seems like those are two of the things that veterinarians tell most dog owners to do. Switch diet and switch protein sources. But, that's easier said than done. Some of us think it takes a while for a dog to transition from feed A to feed B. How long a process should that take?
When you want to switch dog foods?
Yeah.
I'd say at the most 5 to 7 days, less than that. It would, you know, I like to divide them into quarters. Some, if you want to get real careful, you can just a little tiny bit each time. But you start with the older dog food, and you start by feeding 75% the older dog food, and then, you know, it's 3/4, and then one part your new food.
Yeah.
2 days, and then after 2 days, increase that to half and half, 50-50, and then the next couple of days, make it 75% new food and 25% older food, and then after about, you know, 5 or 6 days, you're ready to usually have no problem at all.
Oh, yeah.
I would expect very minimal changes in your dog when you switch diets within the same brand and the same product line, just flavors. And you may want to take a little bit more time if you're doing something more dramatic. The main thing is, though, think about it, how by diversifying what you're feeding the dogs in their menu, how much safer it's much less likely you're going to have the results of having a defective batch of dog food have a much more dramatic effect, because you just keep feeding that same defect over and over again.
Yeah, there's a cumulative factor. I'm getting back to my fishing roots, if you will, where the reason we don't eat some of the fish that we catch is because the mercury has started at the bottom of the food chain and has gone all the way up, and then the big fish that you can't hope to catch, in my case, not very often, but they have been ingesting mercury-laden small fish. So it's a cumulative effect, and I'm sure that's the same perhaps in the melamine question or any of those other questions that we've talked about. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Dr. Mike Sagman, the founder of dogfoodadvisor.com. Mike, you asked me to ask you about ingredient splitting and the voodoo that some of the dog food manufacturers employ. Why don't you explain what you mean there?
I'm glad you reminded me. We frequently see, even some of the biggest manufacturers will tell you right on the label, right, you know, just or and on their website, meat is the first ingredient. Chicken is always the first ingredient. But that is so easy to manipulate. Even human food manufacturers do this. You can manipulate the ingredients. Remember, the federal law requires you to list all ingredients in any food product for human and pet food in order of their pre-cooking weight before you cook the food. They're not required to give you proprietary information, like telling you exactly how many tablespoons of this or how many pounds of that. But they are required to put them in the order of their pre-cooking weight. So if you have a dog food that is really mostly rice, and the second ingredient is chicken, all you have to do is take that rice ingredient, if it's like a pound of rice. You can then take that rice and divide it into two portions, brown rice and white rice, and now the chicken, which you haven't changed at all, is suddenly the first ingredient because you cut the rice half and half between brown and white rice. It doesn't even have to be rice, right? You could take that pound of rice as the first ingredient and divide that into corn and rice. And now suddenly their two smaller portions are now listed below the chicken. The chicken moves up to the first ingredient. Yet in every single example I just gave you, the amount of chicken hasn't changed, but it's suddenly the first ingredient. This is one of the sneakiest ways that pet food formulators are able to fool us. I wouldn't be afraid of it, but when you start choosing dog food because, I like this food because chicken's the first ingredient, I hope that you'll agree, that doesn't mean much, because it's easy to trick a consumer by just moving those. You can move those ingredients around all day long.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's kind of scary. And of course, on that ingredient list, it doesn't tell us the percentages of any of this. But as you mentioned, and I'll point out one more time for my edification, the most prevalent ingredient pre-cooking is the one on the top of that list. And then they go down from there in terms of, I guess it would be weight, now that I think about it, wouldn't it?
Pre-cooking weight.
Yes, yeah.
And that's very important because, you know, when you have meat, that's why meat meal is actually, I'm not saying it's a better ingredient, I'm just saying that it is a stronger, a more concentrated ingredient. And it doesn't move around as much because when you put it into the food, it's already have very little moisture in it.
Right.
But fresh meat, when it says chicken is the first ingredient, that's not the same. It's not unusual to see chicken meal as the first ingredient. But chicken, when you process that in a kibble, all meat, including the meat of your own body, is about 75% water and moisture. So that's why we take all of the guaranteed analysis ingredients and first convert them. I really don't want to get into the nuts and bolts here, but we convert it to what's called dry matter basis.
Sure.
We mathematically remove all the water from the food, from the ingredients, so that we get what's called dry matter basis. So that way we can compare a canned food and a dry food and actually see how much protein is, which one contains more protein. And, you can't just go by the percentage.
And for the record, while most human muscle meat is probably 75% water, mine's about 50% beer. But that's my problem.
I'm afraid mine might be a little bit.
All right. So the elephant in the room, you're the guy. A lot of the dog foods that performance dog owners feed have corn in them. Is corn necessarily a villain in dog food, or is it a matter of moderation in all things, including corn?
Well, you know, this is going to be a controversial thing. So if you have been convinced that corn is a bad ingredient, if you read some of our older articles that we link to, we make a much bigger deal than it is. But all the carbs, corn, wheat, rice, potatoes, all of these carbohydrate ingredients, remember, of the three macro ingredients, protein, carbohydrates, and fats, those three, the word essential is a very important word in nutrition. What the word essential means is that a nutrient that's considered an essential nutrient, by definition, in the business of nutrition, is a nutrient that the animal cannot make for him or herself. A really good example is vitamin C. We develop scurvy. Dogs don't develop scurvy when they don't have vitamin C. We do, because we don't make vitamin C and dogs do. So when you look at vitamin C for us, it's considered an essential nutrient. We can't live without it. Dog vitamin C is not on that list. Amino acids, which make up all proteins, a list of amino acids that are essential for a dog are different than a list of essential amino acids for a human being and for every animal. The concept of being essential is carbohydrates are not essential. There is no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. So corn, wheat, your dog will do fine without any carbohydrates in their diet. However, they do have to have protein and they do have to have fat. The reason that they're vilified is that, let's be honest, the reason that you see so much more carbohydrate in a dog food is it's a cheap form of energy. It's an excellent source of energy, calories, particularly for sporting dogs like you guys, that your listeners have. It's not unusual. And you'll also see that these highly active, the dog foods that are designed for active dogs and sporting dogs do have a higher concentrate of fat. It's okay to have some carbs in there. It's really not a major issue. But when you see someone trying to say that corn is nutrient rich, there are trace nutrients. There are minerals and there are vitamins in corn. But from a standpoint of nutrient value, they're kind of low. So they're there mostly to provide cheap energy. And they also make it, you can't actually make kibble without having carbohydrates. It's in order to form the gelatins, the gelatinous product that goes into kibble that you extrude and bake. There's almost always some form of carbohydrate in there in order to make the biscuits.
Wow. Eye-opening yet again. And I'm going to encourage everybody who's listening right now to take a long look at dogfoodadvisor.com. Dr. Mike Sagman, you have been a wealth of information. I am so glad that I was patient enough to wait for you to come on the podcast with us. This is the kind of stuff that we obsess over in the bird dog world, and you have just opened several hundred thousand pairs of eyes. I can almost guarantee it. We are getting down to the nubs here on your portion of the show. Is there anything you want to leave us with before I turn you loose to go back to doing something important instead of talking to me?
No, I am really thankful to be on your, I know your podcast is very popular, and I'm honored to be here. I've enjoyed this just as much, and I'm honored that you've asked me on, Scott.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for for helping me get through this. I don't like to give a lot of interviews, but this was fun.
You did great, by the way, and it was fun, and I appreciate that. You're very kind, and everybody who listens will be grateful as well. Dr. Mike Sagman, dogfoodadvisor.com. Get on that site and learn everything about the food you're feeding or the ones you want to feed. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Mike.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, Scott.
And you stick around, you listeners, because I've still got lots more to talk about, including our public access feature, This Land is Your Land. I'll be giving you some suggestions about that sort of thing, and in particular, one of my top three states to visit for public access and wild bird hunting. But in the meanwhile, welcome to our newest sponsor, Gunner Kennels. If you're looking for the Yeti of dog crates, well, go no further than gunner.com. These guys have figured it out. I've been coveting them for a while. We've been working together for almost a year now, and they're finally on board here at the Upland Nation podcast. One of the nice things about their kennels, besides being almost bomb-proof, and you can watch the videos to prove that claim at gunner.com, is the way they allow you to experiment with sizes and configurations. If you have an Apple device of any sort, you can basically plop your dog down next to a Gunner kennel in your computer or your handheld device and mess around and see if your dog's going to fit right, see where he's going to go in and where his shoulders and his head are going to be. It's all this augmented reality stuff that is becoming very fashionable. Learn all about it at gunner.com. And then save yourself 10% plus free shipping on any purchase over $200 at dogtra.com. You can get your hands on that T&B dual collar that I like so much. Working with Flick every day on steadiness and on force fetching, and I'm using both of those Dogtra T&B dual collars, one on the front, one on the back. You want to save some money, use the code SLUN10 for 10% off anything over $200 plus free shipping on anything over $200. It's all at dogtra.com. Well, if you've been following this podcast for a while, you know I'm big on this public access thing, hunting all that land that we own or that we have through our collective dollars purchased access to. We call the feature This Land is Your Land because that's what it's all about. If you want more details on this particular one or any number of others, go to findbirdhuntingspots.com and search by region, search by keyword, you name it, you can search it there. That's a brand new feature at findbirdhuntingspots.com. When I was at Pheasant Fest a couple weeks ago, if I had a nickel for every time somebody asked me the question, if you had to hunt in just one state, which would you choose? Well, that's a real tough question, but I did narrow it down to three states that are on the top of the list for various reasons, and I'm going to share one of them with you right now. You may be surprised, but it is Montana. Here are some of the reasons I like Montana for well-managed, easily accessed public ground and private ground open to the public. They have a great program called block management that basically compensates landowners only based on the traffic that they get. That's why they are so adamant about you signing in every time you access some of that block management land. The reason I like it is, as an entrepreneur and a capitalist, you know, if the farmer is not taking good care of his land, you're not going to hunt it and they're not going to get paid. So take a look at their atlas for that, as well as these other attributes. Wide open country, lots of grasslands and lots of prairies, and that's where my favorite species hang out. Sage grouse, Hungarian partridge, sharp-tailed grouse. You can watch your dog run away for 3 days, it's so flat. And if you stand on a tuna fish can, you can watch him run away for a week. Now, in addition to all the wild, there's enough civilization and towns with services to make your visit comfortable, no matter what you need. If you're a Flushing dog owner, the Big Sky Prairies may be a bit of a challenge. You may not be able to get close enough to a dog, or the dog may not be able to get close enough to birds to give you a shot. Now, there is a downside. That is that virtually every major town in Montana has at least one craft brewery. No, I'm just joking there. That's the upside. There's trout fishing certain times a year, if you're so inclined, and you never know, it's become a mecca for celebrities. You might just sit next to somebody like Hank Jr. or Ted Turner. Unfortunately, a lot of the locals have decided that they've had too many visitors, and sometimes their attitude is a little bit less than welcoming. But you're there to bird hunt. Montana is a place to do it. Good luck if you go. Check out findbirdhuntingspots.com. Search for Montana. See what you learn there as well. And while you're at findbirdhuntingspots.com, don't forget to sign up for the mailing list. You'll get an alert every once in a while, and you will also be eligible to win that pointer over and under shotgun, any gauge you like. It's all at findbirdhuntingspots.com. And check out the ways you can fit yourself for custom hearing protection devices at espamerica.com. That's how I did it. You can get fitted in the comfort of your own town. You don't need to be the dancing bear on display at a sportsman's show, sitting there on a stool while they shove stuff into your ears and everybody points and smiles. No, go to espamerica.com and find out how to get your custom fitted hearing protection devices right in your own town through a local dealer. And with that, I am going to visit with my dog, get him ready for his next Montana trip. But before I do, thank you for listening. Hope you learned something from Dr. Mike Sagman at dogfoodadvisor.com. Maybe even a tip or two from me. Save you some of the angst and headaches from last time around. And thank you again to everybody who writes in and talks to us about all the things that are important to them when they are hunting, training, and taking care of their own dogs. If you want to share your ideas, go to the Upland Nation Facebook page or to the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page. Either one will work for me, and maybe we'll get you on the program sometime. If you want to tell your friends about it, I'd sure appreciate it. Ask them to listen. Please subscribe, rate, or review this broadcast, because that kind of stuff matters when it comes to sponsorships and also to building an audience of more people who love what you do and can offer up suggestions. That's enough for me and my talking. Now it's time for you to go out and play with your dog. Thank you again for listening. I'm Scott Linden. It's the Upland Nation Podcast. I'll see you in the field.